This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 2nd of August 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to edition 317 of the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bound, and Andrew Tuck.
On today's show, we'll be looking at where technology meets culture and design with a man who fuses the two of them in museum spaces around the world. Co-founder of TelArt, Matt Cottam, will be there with us a little bit later.
We'll also meet Japanese photographer Tomoko Yoneda, whose serene images only tease and hint at the drama and unrest of the locations she shot in.
And we'll be slipping on our Nikes and Adidas for a chat with Jeff Staple, the sneakerhead whose shoe designs are now in the Brooklyn Museum.
That's all coming up. Plus, Tom Tedwards Edwards will be back to regale us with the news. Look ahead, and we'll be playing some great music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. There we have it, Andrew. We've put another one to bed. A magazine, I mean. Mewling and puking in the nurse's arms. She went the September issue. The September issue? Was it the September issue? The October issue?
No, it was a September issue. We just started the October issue. Let's enjoy September, first of all.
I'm just so keen to get on. You know, that's what I'm doing. I'm thinking of December, January already.
Good. Good on you.
Yeah, Christmas.
A forecast. You've done that.
Exactly. It's been a good one. We have escaped, in fact, the kind of clutches of upstairs. It's kind of been a bit of a more of a chilled week, it seems.
Well, we seem to be on schedule for the first time ever in our lives. I don't know how that's happened.
The constructive bullying has worked.
All that kind of like shouting actually paid off. And we had a nice party this week as well for the launch of The Escapist.
We managed to
fit that in as well.
Do you have a lobster roll?
Most evenings. Anyway,
Andrew will explain what that joke means by the end of the program. He'll have written me. He'll have passed a note.
And I had a sport joke this week as well.
Oh yeah, that's good.
It's too complicated to explain because it involves a cricketer. I don't know anything about cricket, but anyway.
Well, I think maybe some of our listeners might be familiar with the captain of the England cricket team, Alistair Cook. And I think I shouted out, "Oh, Cook's out!" And you go, "Well, there goes dinner."
Yeah. That's a sports joke.
That's the first time
I've been in with the sports kids ever in my life.
Probably come September time, when the football season starts, you can bring out your one football joke.
Okay.
Let's not spoil it.
we'll save that one.
No plot spoiler on the Monocle Weekly.
But anyway,
we'll save that up.
I think I hear a little kind of flapping sound in the wind. I think something's coming our way.
Is it a Tedwado? Is it a bird? Is it a plane? Is it a Tedwado?
Who's that moving at the speed of light? Darting around the globe with his golden cape aflutter, waggling his chunky glasses, and giving us a knowing wink as he passes. His cuddly beauty silhouetted against the stars. Who could have such a wise yet pretty face? Or such a wiggly bottom? Could it be? Oh yes, it's Monocle's very own Clark Kent, our intrepid reporter and all-round lifesaver. And look, he's coming into land. Please welcome the one and only Super Tedwards, the news bear who likes his stories served with ice cream, please. We love you, Super Tedwards.
News bear. Hi.
Oh, dear. I've got a question for you, Andrew. What's that sound effect once Super Tedwards has crash landed? What's that sort of... What's that supposed to be?
I think that's him emerging from the rubble, chipper as ever, with a sheaf of news.
Back on his feet.
Yeah,
I
think that's what it's alluding to.
You crash through the greenhouse and you still come out with a kind of like a spring in your step.
I just wake up in the mornings now hearing those sound effects. Every waking moment.
You've succeeded in life when you've got your own theme tune.
I've got a selection to choose from. Depending on how derided I feel like being.
Does it play in your head when you're walking down the street?
Pretty much.
Okay.
Yeah.
We could bring out a Christmas CD with a full collection.
People would be fighting in the aisles not to have to listen to that.
Can you live up to the billing, though? What is in the news look ahead, Tom?
In terms of general incomprehensibility, possibly. Let's have a rattle through things, shall we?
Okay.
A couple of stories out of the US. So, Thursday, the first Republican presidential debate is taking place. It's quite interesting. It's in Cleveland. That's not that interesting. It's on Fox News, which is par for the course.
They need a lot of chairs, I hear.
Well, they will.
How many contestants are there on this?
Well, this is just going to be the top 10,
right,
according to most recent polling. So it's likely to be usual suspects, probably, you got the likes of Jeb Bush, Marco Rubio, Mike Huckabee, Rand Paul, Donald Trump, tragically, still featuring prominently.
Right. It's going to be one of the big ones.
Yep.
I don't know. We've seen people be front and centre for a while before and then drift away. Yeah. We can but hope for the future of the free world.
Cook's out. Oh, no, sorry.
That's the day after National Underwear Day in the US.
Do you wear them or not wear them on that day?
Oh, you absolutely wear them. You probably wear several pairs.
Yeah.
As a super Ted Woods, of course, I'll be wearing mine outside my trousers.
Yes, it's always obvious when you've got yours on.
Yeah.
What's that?
That's that noise again.
Oh, okay.
But they have a tail hole.
It's a little thing. It's like a rabbit's one.
It's like a rabbit's tail, yeah.
I like the way you just pulled your bottom round, so you'd have a look.
I'm not an actual cartoon bear. I need to think of that.
Remember that. Have you got a hat with like holes in for your ears to stick out, like Top Cat situation would have?
Yeah, and that's very difficult to
Yogi,
wear.
Yogi wear Bear, for example.
Yogi, did he have...
No, Yogi, I think he's just got a collar and tie. Very smart.
No,
a
tiny hat.
Naked, apart from a collar and tie, like a chipmunk. Yeah.
I was talking about this the other day. Donald Duck, jacket and hat.
Yeah.
When he got out of the bath, put a towel round his waist. So that never made any sense.
No.
There we are. Let's talk balls.
There is a thing. I cannot think of a single completely naked cartoon character other than maybe Tweety Pie. All cartoon characters have some
Bugs Bunny used to dress up quite a lot.
He had a bow tie and gloves.
No, not just generally, did he?
Bugs Bunny, I think so.
Oh, well,
We'll come back to that.
Board gaming. Very big week in the world of board gaming. The annual World Championships taking place in Lancaster, Pennsylvania from Monday. All week that goes on. Quite sweetly on there.
Any board game.
Promotional material. Or a huge range. Different categories though, Andrew. So you have the fantasy category, diplomacy, tile laying. That's a subset.
Scrabble,
that's a subset, yeah. Empire building, sort of war game subcategories. Mm-hmm. Best to probably leave them to it. Quite sweetly, you're invited to bring your own board so there's enough to go around. I rather like the sort of collegiate nature of that.
Caring and sharing, I like it.
But maybe that's quite democratic. Slightly more high-end, in Monte Carlo, from Tuesday, in fact, the World Backgammon Championships at the Fairmont. Mm. High-end table-based.
High-end backgammon, yeah.
Table-based
sports.
I
wonder how smart that back sort of mahogany.
Well, they have a cocktail reception. I bet you don't get that in Lancaster, Pennsylvania.
Bring your own cocktails.
There's ladies, seniors, the main tournament, and doubles World Championship.
Would you go to that? Are you wide aware winter evening with a Scrabble? With a backgammon?
I don't really understand it. I've got to be honest. Is that bad?
I like Scrabble.
Need to be in the tile-laying section.
You'd be in the tile-laying
section. Pennsylvania?
One summer, I had a summer job at university where I worked for a toy factory where the toys were returned to. I was in the returns department. So these games would come back from kind of different places. And I had to mark down on a sheet what was wrong with the toy. So it was
such a sad story.
That's such a great...
It was like a novelistic job.
Yeah,
so the dogs got fleas, which was one of the dogs. It was one of the games where you wound the dog's tail up until the fleas jumped off. And I had to put broken tail on dog.
Oh my God, this is brilliant.
It's so sad. And then what happens to them?
Or just fleas don't jump.
That's amazing.
What became of these items?
I did buckaroo.
Yeah, what wouldn't buckaroo?
Bucket missing. Often the bucket wasn't packed when they packed the buckaroo. Kplunk didn't work.
Didn't work. Mr. Potato Head, only one
didn't
ear.
Purr. Rubik's Cube, broken.
It's really fucking impossible.
Listen, I've been doing this for hours and hours and hours and I can't make it work. That's extraordinary.
And amazing. Then at the end of the day, this was my job, at the end of the day, you had to fill a skip with all the return toys. And then before you went home, you had to jump up and down on them. Because it was...
Jump in
the skip. They wanted to make sure that none of the broken dogs got fleas somehow got back into the community.
What a fascinating job. I wonder if this still exists.
I hope so.
Must do.
Kept me busy for a summer.
It's quite extraordinary.
And by the end of it, I could do the Rubik's Cube in under 5 minutes. That was good. That was the real pay for
it.
I'm not sure I could do it now at
the Rubik's Cube World Championships. 8 seconds you got to do it.
At that time, no one knew how to do it. I was one of the few in Britain who could complete it.
Did you just take off all the little colour bits?
No.
That's what I did.
I learned how to do it.
At least Tom knows where all his toys came from now.
Anyway.
Oh, the broken ones have more charm. Thanks.
More holiday jobs next week.
Thanks, Mum and Dad. Yeah. I think a holiday job is a good subsection. We should get that going for this show.
Let's revisit our holiday jobs.
I got where we started now. Oh, yeah, the board game championships in Lancaster, Pennsylvania.
Oh, yeah, yeah, so that's all happening. We got time for more? I don't know.
One more. Let's have one more.
One more. What should we do? Well, let's do a goodbye, because on Thursday, it's the John Stewart's last hurrah in his Daily Show chair. And there was a lot about this at the time. They announced the succession with this South African comedian, Trevor Nelson.
Oh, yeah, this guy, yeah.
He's taking over next month, sort of towards the end of September, but it's John Stewart's farewell, so I imagine he'll have a few witticisms. Could be quite emotional.
Hopefully have a bit of a zinger to off the back of the old Republican
contestant. Yeah, and I just think he's significant, not just because he's obviously a bit of a wit, he's a good presenter, but he's also, it's kind of readjusted. We started off by talking about the presidential debates being on Fox News. I feel like he's in some small way readjusted the dynamics of the way that America does current affairs. He's almost like the most trusted TV voice. It's not the anchors anymore at the networks. So it's quite a big
moment. It's quite a bellwether for how the American media deals with politics, I think, for sure. Yeah.
Well, absolutely.
Yeah. I said bellwether.
Well done. Thank you. Thank you very much, Ted Woods.
Matt Cottam is the co-founder of TellArt, a design company that looks to make technology usable, interactive, and perhaps most tricky of all, meaningful in spaces used by the public. TellArt's line of work has seen them collaborating with London Science Museum, where in 2012 they integrated the ideas of visiting the museum both in physical form and online through the Google Chrome Web Lab. And this year they've helped create the Colour of Life exhibition at the California Academy of Sciences, which uses interactive environments to reveal the role that colour plays across the Earth's massive spectrum of existence.
Over the space of 15 years, the company has grown to 26 people, with offices in San Francisco, Amsterdam, New York, and Providence, Rhode Island. And Matt is here in London today to tell us about technology contributing to spaces such as the modern day museum, and how to make them places that we still want to seek out and gather within. Matt, welcome to the Monocle Weekly. We should ask you first, where did this all begin? Is it beginning in the world of technology, or that you were in the world of museums? How did you come to marry these two worlds?
Thanks very much. Well, I studied industrial design, so I have this real passion for materials and craft and tools. And having done that at a very traditional art and design school in the 90s, it was at the same time where a lot of digital technologies were emerging and becoming a part of everything. But we didn't want to lose what we loved about stone and textile and glass and ceramic. And so we set out to create a company 15 years ago to merge these two things, and also to use them as platforms for communicating interesting content about the world, like science museum exhibitions or experiences of brands that are immersive and tangible and interactive, and even the future of government that we've been working on in Dubai.
We use the word interactive in the introduction to you, Matt. It's probably a word that you trail around, like having your own soundtrack.
I really,
if you were a character in a film, yeah, there would be the sound of interactivity around
maybe,
you.
Maybe.
It's a funny thing, isn't it? I wanted to ask you about the definition of that for you.
Well, because, I'd like to talk about that, because it's interesting. We resist this idea of interaction design as its own discipline, because really, coming from the story I was just telling, we see data and sensors and cameras and networks and pixels is really just an extension of the traditional materials of beautiful stone and
anything you pick up should be interactive. Any nice object in the hand is interactive. It kind of gets misunderstood. It's always about computers and technology, isn't it?
Yeah, there are nuances to how people define it, and whether it's reciprocal actions with a piece of software that actually acts on its own in an algorithmic way to respond to you, or we are interacting also right now. But I think in common usage, when we're around, people are actually talking about computation in things, hopefully.
Yeah. Now, Matt, we should look at one of the projects you've done. A really interesting one is in Dubai, where you were asked to kind of reimagine kind of how you'd present information. And one of the things was around healthcare in that country. A really interesting display where people got to walk through an exhibition, and it kind of challenged them over how healthy they were and how they would unpack their day if they were going to be challenged to take more sport and things. Could you just tell us a little bit how that story began, and just give listeners a couple of examples of how you brought the story to life, maybe?
Sure, of course. The government of the UAE, the Prime Minister's office in Dubai, has this really great vision to be the best government service providers in the world, and they are very adventurous in the way that they explore these the future, because they have a relatively short history compared to places like London, and they have a great wealth of intelligent people like this guy, Noah Rafford, who's MIT grad and now works in the strategy department there. And together we created this experience about the future of government. And one of the aspects of government there is providing healthcare. And one of the things that we learned from sitting in many different government offices and listening to people talk about the future of how they imagine their jobs and what their pain points were, was that hospitals would be likely distributed into neighborhoods, into parts of your house, into your pocketbook, into being a part of your car. We already see in the quantified self movement all of these sensors like Fitbit or bathroom scales that connect to the web. And you can imagine...
That's really embarrassing.
tweeting your bathroom scale is something I've managed
to
avoid.
Shame yourself into it.
Maybe I should. Yeah, that's right. So what we created was a beautiful bathroom. It was made out of marble and beautiful glass, and we created all in the Veneto in Italy, and then we put screen behind the mirror that would suggest things to visitors like, we've detected that three people in your office are presenting with cold symptoms, so we're adding some vitamin C to your breakfast downstairs in the kitchen right now. And it was meant to provoke questions about the role that we want technology to have in our lives and the role that we want technology to have between us and our government. And other ones were about education, where kids could, you could imagine a classroom where kids would work with genetic modification to imagine new types of plant forms that could grow in the desert, and also smart city infrastructure and things like that.
What I liked about that was I imagined that, you know, not particularly in UAE, which is a bit more open, but in some more closed Arabic societies, it was a kind of a vision of how, you know, perhaps, you know, women who couldn't just kind of get in the car and drive off to see the doctor if they wanted to, they could be kind of, you know, checking in on their healthcare at home, that there was a way of delivering, you know, a bit more knowledge, you know, to you literally at the front line as you got up in the morning.
Yeah, that's right. And also, we're looking at the future. So then it was 15 years out. Now this year, we're looking at 2050. And with people living longer, you can imagine even more generations of people living at home and the elderly living at home. And in the Middle East, especially, they have very tight family structures where all the generations will live together in the same house. So having this kind of flexible, adaptive healthcare system distributed into the homes makes a lot of sense, I think.
It's one of those things that I wonder what sort of trail a company like Telart leaves, actually. And I wonder whether a success for you is when nobody realises they're using your ideas and your equipment, or whether they do know. Do you know what I mean?
I wonder how
likely you want people to wear the learning that you've given them. You know what I mean?
I think we like to think that people aren't paying attention to the fact that it's made out of technology or emerging technologies. As much as we love those things as materials, we hope that people are truly having an experience of immersion in the content, a suspension of their disbelief that maybe they're there in the future, or they're looking through the eyes of a snake or a mouse in the colors exhibition we just did in California.
Yeah.
And so
I guess
we don't
the,
like
the
to
success
make it
in, of a book is when you don't know you're reading one. You're just suddenly
exactly,
in a different world.
Exactly.
It should be like that,
and
I guess.
And that's a great way to describe immersion. And we just are able to do that engaging all the senses, because we have these three-dimensional environments, architecture and objects. And also we can use, we use scent designers last year, we use flavor designers, we use sound designers all the time. So,
Matt, tell me, when you get the call from a museum, is one of the things on their mind that they need to always be recruiting a younger generation to come through their front doors? So, you know, obviously, we all know that technology is, you know, is the interface through which lots of young people kind of engage with all sorts of worlds. Are they intrigued to see how you recruit a younger generation of people for their museums?
That is, yeah, that's true. We spend a lot of time teaching in some of the top design schools around the world every year for the last 15 years. And I think that's a real advantage for us to recruit for ourselves, but also to really stay on top of trends and how people expect to have content brought to them, how the younger people have grown accustomed to not just seeing the real thing, which is what museums have over everything else. They've got the real artifact. But they also expect layers of information, different lenses to look at it through. It's not enough to just look at a painting. I want to also understand the time that it was in and see overlays of how it was made, or the life of the artist, or I want to try to make one myself. And this participation in a museum is a thing that's growing and becoming more complex. And I think that younger generations are demanding that of cultural institutions. They want to be part of the content. They don't want to just go there to consume it.
And I wanted to, before we go, I wanted to go right back to the beginning, the conversation we started having, Matt, about your time at design school and noticing that, well, maybe this is the question, whether you noticed that there was a divorce between the sort of hands-on designers who are into materials and stone and fabric and different things, and the people that ended up going to Silicon Valley and making their own startups and stuff. Do you see still that there is quite a chasm between those two disciplines, a lack of sympathy between the two, perhaps?
Less and less, I think. I hope that they're not in competition with one another, and that even if you're a stone sculptor, that you can appreciate using a program to do a simple plan for the piece of stone you're going to cut. It can be a very small part of your process. Or in our case, where we're doing 3D printed ceramics right now, we're using data from live sensors out in the world to drive the shapes of teacups. And so I think it can have varying degrees of influence on the things we make, but it's less and less common that people live in a vacuum of purely analog tools and materials.
And perhaps just quickly, Matt, before we really do finish, tell me, if someone goes out this weekend, where could they see some of your projects actually in action?
Well, you could go to the California Academy of Science in San Francisco. It's a beautiful Renzo Piano building and a great museum. And we have an exhibition there about how animals see color.
I want to know that. So that's good.
Black and white and zigzags. That's not the official line. Sometimes.
I think that's how 3-month-old children see
it. It's a zebra with a hangover. Okay. Well, Matt Cottam, co-founder of TelArts, how brilliant you are at talking about your work as well. That's always a challenge as well. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much. It's been great.
You're listening to The Monocle Weekly. We'll be talking about photography with Tomoko Yoneda after a song. Time for some brand new music now. This is the serene sound of the Welsh language being put through its experimental pop paces. It's Gwenno with Chwildro. That was Welsh wonder Gwenno with Chwildro.
We should have breakfast together, and lunch, and coffee, and cake, and a forced beer, or even an Aperol Spritz at sunset. And we know just the perfect spot. Come and join us at our London cafe that's just around the corner from our Midori HQ, and also close to the Monocle shop. While you have a great flat white made with all-press coffee, you'll no doubt bump into one of our team and get to hear all the latest from the Monocle world. You can also pick up the latest issue of the magazine. Oh, and we also have space for hosting private lunches and events too. Join us at 18 Chiltern Street in London, and also at our outpost in the Hankyu Men's Department Store in Tokyo. We look forward to seeing you.
London's Grimaldi Gavin Gallery is currently showing the work of Japanese photographer Tomoko Yoneda in an event called Beyond Memory. The images on show depict often enticing landscapes and peaceful scenes, but each one has a deeper, sometimes troubling story behind it. They're locations where unrest and dramatic events have taken place in the past that range from battlefields to the First World War to modern-day disputes over national borders.
Yoneda initially wanted to be a journalist before switching to photography, and there is a documentary-like clarity to her images. But to illuminate the scenes further, she stopped by Midori House a little earlier to tell Rob a little bit more about them.
Tomoko, thanks for joining us on the Monocle Weekly. We're talking about your show Beyond Memory at the Grimaldi Gavin Gallery here in London. We're also kind of talking about your general practice.
All right.
But luckily for us, the idea and the title Beyond Memory kind of drills right down into the heart of your artistic practice.
That's right.
We should tell our listeners that these are, on the face of it, very beautiful images, or images that seem quite calm, have a stillness about them, certainly, but all is given away by the captions. And on the, how did you find this, not this trick, but how did you arrive at this way of doing business and of reaching your work, making it a conversation really between the caption and the image? How did you arrive at that?
I always have been very interested in the relationship between images and text, how it work, how you relate to the images and how you read is very personal level. And what you have learned, or what, how your upbringing or the your sexes, what, female or male, or cultural background or social background you come from, is completely different to how you react to the images. That I have been very interested in. And the text can play the role, I mean, text itself as visual images as well. And if you, what's difficult? Okay, when you look at a glass of water or the milk, if you inform it is a milk, or if you throw into the information, maybe it is a lead or something called poisonous, you know, word, then you step back and think it's completely different to, you know, add it to the image. So I'm very interested in something you read into the images beyond actual surface of the images, which are very different among us, and we cannot see what people's drawing into the picture.
And there's an interesting idea here, because photography is always, we were always taught that photography started off as reportage, that it was always true, you know, that the image, if it's captured by a camera as opposed to an artist's paintbrush, is not a rendering of something, but it's the sort of truth about something. And I think that your work takes that idea for a bit of a ride, and it says that this image is might be beautiful, it might stand for something, and it might be a shorthand in your head for something, or it might be a nice memory. But actually, it's not until you read the captions mm-hmm. on your work that the full truth is uncovered, or rather that the twist in the story is uncovered. Is that right? Does that sound about right?
Yeah, I think so.
And is that?
Yeah, but my captions are quite objective. I'm trying to be very objective, kind of factual, you know, locations or what happened there. So I wouldn't give, you know, more than this is a terrible site, or this is how the people treated such and such different nations. Then always coin has two sides, or, you know, what you experienced in the past, that's play a role how you look at or react to the images. That's what I'm interested in, because everybody's different. Yeah, I think that's the basis. But we're talking about a very particular series of work, I think.
Yeah.
So the title, the series, Scene, that's we particularly
Yes,
talking
I suppose
about.
We're talking about your work that is that tackles things, or is a picture, for example, of an aeroplane in the sky, and it's something that you saw over England, and it's a B-52, and it's come back from a bombing raid in Iraq during the second Iraq war. And you look up and you think, in the sky, and you think maybe, oh, well, I wonder where that aeroplane's coming mm-hmm. back from, full of happy holidaymakers, because you can't necessarily recognise the outline, and then you know what it is. And it's these sorts of things, the kind of, the killer is in the line of caption, mm-hmm. isn't it? And because I suppose your captions are, you could say, dry, they're entirely factual, that they have that added poignancy.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to talk about your early days, when you were going to be a journalist, you were going to be a journalist with words rather than pictures. Tell me about the point at which you decided to pick up the camera and for that to become your work.
Actually, I decided to go to study journalism in America. And the first I arrived there, and in my ability of speaking English wasn't sufficient enough. And I struggled. But my father was a keen amateur photographer, and he always took photographs, and over the time was black and white, mainly. And he had a dark room in my house, in our house, which I didn't see, but my mother told me he had a little dark room, process his film and little prints and stuff. So I inherited his camera. That was Canon normal manual 35mm camera. And I took with me to go to America to study journalism. And the war I faced about my language ability, and I was a little bit interested in the camera mechanical side as well. And at the time, I know that recently, you know, camera has been widely available in the, you know, in the 80s, remember in Japan, lots of women taking photographs. Yeah. But at the time, when I was studying photography, was a mechanical thing. It was still a machine, and I have to learn it. I wanted to conquer how to use my dad's camera. And I took a summer course, and I was quite good at it. I was hooked to do photography. Then I just, I thought visual images, photography, a lot of photography in a newspaper, journalism always has been very important, which I know of. And if I could express myself through the camera rather than using pens, I think that is the plus point also.
And is it something about the directness of photography that attracts you to it? The fact that, you know, it's the great cliche that a picture can tell 1,000 words, or can do the job of 1,000 words. Mm-hmm. That's originally what turned you onto it. And we've talked about some of your work, and this is the body of work in Beyond Memory, which is the stuff that is a beautiful picture, or it's a serendipitous picture with a sort of killer caption attached to it. And then some of your other work is deeply detailed, and some of your mm-hmm. work that deals with crystals and flowers and minerals and stuff. How do you decide what sort of projects you're going to work on and when? Are they commissions, or do you just, into your head, you just get into something?
Well, for particular, this exhibition, I was working with the curator. His name is Paul Womble. He has known my work quite some time. And we sat down and looked at our work, at my works. And because I haven't had my show in London for some time, we thought it would be better to show a variety of body of work of mine, which the audience in England haven't seen.
So it's a bit, you can kind of trace a history through your different styles and through the different things that have been your subjects for a few years. And I'm interested, I know you've been asked about this before, the idea of collective memory, which is kind of very important to certain things, whether you're making a comment or what, you know, when people read the caption to a picture and they know that it deals with Japan in the Second World War, or it deals with the Soviet Empire taking over Eastern Europe and troubled and interesting moments in history. And the idea of collective memory is an interesting one. Do you think everybody, because obviously people will see different things in these images when you simply have such a straight caption. Are you interested in what people say and what people think as they walk around an exhibition of your photographs, or do you want to let them make up their own minds?
Both are important, I think. Of course, I'll be interested in what people think and to read my imageries and reading my text, the titles. But we cannot see whatsoever. It's mental images of themselves. So I really leave it up to the audience to make the imagery, beyond my imagery.
Okay, so you can just suggest something to them and they really finish the picture in their head. Okay, because I'm thinking about a very beautiful and poignant image that most people, I think, would, within a reading of history, or at least one side of it, would find poignant, which is this swimming bath in Hungary, in Budapest, I suppose. And it's I think this swimming pool complex was a sort of Stalinist gift or something. And then this is obviously after the fall of communism in Hungary. And there's simply a couple embracing in this kind of cold-looking, but also quite hospitable swimming pool. I wonder about that one. Did people pose for that? Or was that a serendipitous moment?
It's quite often it happens. I was going to take photograph the swimming pool of the social realist typical facade of the swimming pool. I wanted to take photograph, and I set up a 5x4 camera first. But around that time, I started carrying my 6x7 camera also, which has more immediate mobility for me. Then the swimming pool photograph, what happened was, so I had a 5x4 camera set up to take photograph, architectural photograph. Then the time kids swimming lesson was happening, and I was waiting to gonna be calm and nobody, you know, going to be around. Then kids lesson finished. Then just about, you know, taking photograph, then just a couple appeared. Of course, you know, before I take photograph, I thought I should tell them because I already have a big camera in front of them. I said, you know, I can't
maybe
talk
that's
to
what made them come. You know?
No, I don't. Well, I don't know. Could be.
This lady's going to make us famous.
Yeah, but I didn't tell them. I can't speak Hungarian, so I just, you know, is it okay, camera? I say, yes. And they submerge themselves in the swimming pool and start, I don't know, embracing. Typical, that's a scene of lovers, or a perfect kind of, you know, quiet, just themselves in the blue water, very calm.
Yeah, it is. It's a deeply calm image. And it's only, as I say, it's only on reading the caption do you realize that there's the strange and complicated and political history of where that, what that swimming pool might have meant in different eras and all the rest of it.
I saw, the taking photograph of people, you need a quite quick sort of approach to. So I abandoned my 5.4 and I took my medium format, hold it very still and just click the shutter.
Like a cowboy.
Yeah, well, yes.
And I wanted to, when do you decide where you're going to go and take your camera? How do you do your research? Do you go, okay, because there's a lovely picture that you took of a Trabant on the 50th parallel, road that is the 50th parallel.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and there are hot spots, you might say, political parts of the world or places that you've covered, but also the idea of just taking a plane flying through the sky and then realizing that it's a B-52 bomber is an interesting thing. How deliberate are your seemingly serendipitous moments?
I do research before I go. So, and of course, I have to plan the schedule and book an airplane or book a train. So before going to the places, I always do the research. So those places are chosen places.
Yeah. So you've ticked off a lot of kind of places where there's been eruptions of emotion or hardship or great pleasure as well. I mean, you know, these are the places. Is there something, and this is something that your pictures hopefully capture, do you feel something when you're there? Is there something that you're trying to instill in your photographs when you're there? Or is it quite a technical process when you're actually on the ground in a place where there's been a momentous moment in history?
Wow.
Do you feel a little tingle go up your spine? Or is it only when you get the photographs back from the darkroom?
That's right, because most of my work, I mean, 99% are 5x4, 6x7 still film images. So at the location, at the moment I'm taking photograph, I'm not sure how it's going to turn out. So when I get film back with the contact sheets, or it could be just I scan it myself in my studio, when I see with a little loop there, if the focus okay, to the moment, fine, and the color looks negative, density looks okay, then I feel very, very good.
No, it's good. And I've got one final question for you, Tomoko, which is, do you know when you've nailed it? Do you know when you've, I always ask this to artists, do you know when you've finished something? I mean, you know, presumably you have a number of pictures to choose from. You get on a plane, you get on a train, you make your way to the 50th parallel. It's a long way away from most places. How many shots do you take before you get the right one? Or do you know? I mean, I wonder,
yeah,
whether you can tell whether the...
Of course, B-52 is only one on those shots on that perfect frame.
Yeah.
Or it's a swimming pool. I shot maybe 3 shots, but embracing one is only one. And if you see my wedding photograph, wedding boat in North Korea and China border, that was only one.
You got one chance to get
one chance to get in the perfect moment. I wait the boats to come in the middle. So all the preparations and all the emotion is focused on the one dot on the plane, on the middle of the river. But I think when I click the photograph, I think all the researches I've done and what I've seen on the media or what I read in the books, from when I was a little to right now in living in England, London, everything came down to me.
Yeah.
So just the moment is the most important.
Tomoko Yoneda, thank you very much for your time today.
Well, thank you.
And Beyond Memory is on show at London's Grimaldi Gavin Gallery until this Friday, August the 7th.
Time for a cuppa as Monocle Film spins the globe and drops in on 3 inspiring tea emporiums, blending contemporary business ideas with time-honored traditions.
Tea is still leading a wallflower existence compared to specialty coffee. And we decided we needed to communicate much differently to make it fun and rewarding to engage with this higher level of tea.
Tea Time in Berlin, New York,
and London. Watch our Monocle briefing in the film section of monocle.com.
Jeff Staple is the New York mind behind the eponymously named Staple Design and Creative Studio, as well as the owner of the Lower East Side boutique Reed Space. Clothing is obviously integral to Jeff's output, but when it comes to footwear, sneakers specifically, or trainers to our European listeners, are Jeff's enthusiasm and his expertise is in a different league.
His cool grey take on the Nike Dunk Low Pro SB, that's a sneaker by the way, with Jeff's instantly recognisable pigeon logo on them, caused a near riot for sneakerheads when they were unleashed on the streets back in 2005. And the last pristine pair has just been donated by Jeff to a new exhibition, The Rise of Sneaker Culture, at the Brooklyn Museum. Jeff also recently curated an auction in which many pristine models went under the hammer for thousands of dollars, and he joins us on the line from California now to tell us why sneakers hold such mythic status in the modern clothing marketplace. Jeff, welcome to the show. First of all, congratulations on these Nikes that you customized, causing, you know, riots in the streets. I mean, that's quite a feat for the humble sneaker. What's the secret of your pigeon success?
You know, it wasn't our goal to cause a riot. I just want to say we don't want to put lives at stake.
No, indeed. I mean in a good way, you know.
Yes, I mean, our goal is, you know, to make really great covetable items that people want, and sometimes these guys take it a little bit too far, and it did get quite riotous. NYPD, SWAT had to come out, and I think the thing that really escalated that was people knew that they wouldn't be able to get the shoes because of the demand, so they brought weapons with them to mug the kids that could get them. Oh, so wow. That's where the imbalance started to happen very quickly.
This is kind of like the amusing but slightly dark side of sneaker culture. I mean, we need to go right back to the year dot, I guess, to talk about this stuff. I mean, we're looking at some images here in the studio, Andrew and I, of a show at the Brooklyn Museum with kind of the first ever pair of Converse high tops from 1917, which look pretty similar to the ones that people are still wearing on their feet across the world now. But when did sneakers become like a cultural thing? When did they start changing hands for lots of money? When were the bragging rights about sneakers? Is that an 80s thing?
I would say late 80s, mid 90s more so, when it became covetable. I think in the 80s what happened was, you know, sneakers were always made for performing on court and for athletes. I think what really pushed it out of that category was hip hop. I think before that, like with rock stars or punk stars, they weren't really rocking sneakers, or it wasn't really about their sort of fashion style. When hip-hop artists came about and people looked up to them musically, they would then look at what they were wearing. And hip-hop stars were wearing sneakers and trainers in all different weird ways, without laces, oversized, tongues sticking out of their pant legs, you know. So they were really redefining how sneakers were to be worn. And I think that was the first step, but it still wasn't quite the place where it is now, where it becomes covetable. I think the next thing that came was in the 90s, when athletes, but Michael Jordan is obviously the first one and the most notable one, but other ones too, like Andre Agassi and Bo Jackson. These athletes, half because of their actual skill, but the other half because of the incredible marketing of the brands that supported them, really elevated them to like this godlike deity status, you know. And that's where kids just, I mean, between their favorite rapper and then, you know, Bo Jackson or Michael Jordan, like, you can't even fault the kid for coveting the thing that these guys have on their feet anymore. So that's where it really broke the mold, I feel.
And Jeff, are the ones that are most valuable, is that simply based on scarcity? Is it these kind of, I know in the collection there's, you know, there's a Chanel Reebok, for example. Is it just the rare examples that really people have in collections?
It's interesting. To be collectible, yes, it should be, and 9 times out of 10 it is rare. But the equation doesn't work the other way. So a sneaker company can't just say, we've made 12 of these, and then all of a sudden they become collectible and rare and covetable. It's not as easy as that. There has to be something else involved that escalates it a little bit.
So is that endorsement? Is that the endorsement of I mean, Kanye West, for example? I know he's designed some of the sneakers in this exhibition, for example. But is it the endorsement of a star, sporting or hip hop or otherwise, or is it something to do with the kind of brand DNA and kind of wanting the next thing that comes out of, for example, Nike?
Most of the times it is. I like to call it collaboration versus endorsement. I don't think Kanye would like to call it endorsement either, because endorsement sort of implies like the Chuck Taylor, like, you know, Chuck Taylor was a person that was endorsed by Converse. So collaboration is more so because when you collaborate, you know, the other person actually has a say in what the final outcome of the product looks like. Endorsements, typically, we've made this shoe, put it on your feet, and we'll give you a check. So that there's not.
So that
really
was the olden days, you know. That was the olden days, I guess.
Yes, exactly, and it still happens today. But those shoes, you know, like a generic everyday basketball player X on X team gets a shoe deal, but his shoe is not covetable. I think when you take someone that's respected for their aesthetic and their design sense, and then you collaborate them with a brand that is known for their production skill or technical ability, you can sort of start to create this magic in a bottle. But I call it magic because if you really study this stuff and you look at all the blogs and the magazines that cover this, it's really only 10% of what's made really, really sticks. The other 90 just ends up on, you know, page 15 of a blog and no one ever talks about it again.
And Jeff, you know, what's strange about this, you know, I guess for outsiders, is the very nature of, you know, sneakers is that they are ubiquitous. They are democratic in some sense. They're not hugely expensive when they first come out. So you go to your, you know, your shoe shop of choice or your sports store of choice, and the kind of everything's there. And when you get on the subway, you're just as likely to see, you know, an 80-year-old wearing sneakers as an 8-year-old. But what makes that culture around it still, you know, so valued? Because, you know, there's still shoes that come out, you know, I look around our office and a shoe will come out and you'll suddenly notice the cooler group in the office have all got the same shoe within a matter of weeks. It's funny how they still have this cultural currency despite being so ubiquitous.
Yeah, that's really the beautiful thing about shoes to me is, you mentioned it before, A, the accessibility of it, you know, so, you know, anywhere between $100 and $300, anyone can walk into a store and pick a pair of shoes. The first problem is you've got a wall of shoes at a typical store of like, you know, 100 selections. And so there's a curatorial sense where person A can go in and pick a shoe and he looks like, you know, a dad. And then person B comes out of the store, you know, same store, but he's like the coolest guy on earth. So there's this sort of like anybody can win at this, first of all. Second of all is what you're saying about the sort of duality of shoes, which is it's designed to be worn on your feet and hence pretty destroyed. You know, it's like it's meant to protect your feet. So by using them, you're destroying the thing. But if you don't use it and you just put it on a shelf, you're not using the thing for its intended purpose. And if you think about anything else like that's collectible, you know, like art or, you know, watches or something, they don't deteriorate like a shoe would if you put it on your body. So there's kind of like this, if there's someone that's got a mint pair of Air Jordans or something, you know, there is some extreme care and some deliberateness where like this person said, I'm going to buy this shoe and not use it for its intended purpose. I'm going to put it on a shelf. So there's this kind of like maniacalness about it that's also very, very interesting, I think.
Yeah, and I guess the guy that's got that original pair of Air Jordans from 1985, one of the legendary shoes, one of the legendary sneakers of all time. If you see someone shooting hoops on a basketball court near your house, Jeff, you know that that's the coolest man in the world. It's the kind of person that, you know, will happily leave their Ferrari on the roadside overnight and go to a party because to them it doesn't make any difference. Is that the ultimate coolness, to actually shoot hoops in an original pair of Air Jordans when they're worth, you know, tens of thousands of dollars?
Well, maybe that person's also having dinner on top of his Picasso.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Would you say he's cool or would you say he's stupid?
I don't know. I don't know him. I don't know him, Jeff. I think it's interesting. I have to ask a question that some of our listeners I know will want to know is, when you could buy a pair of, you know, Gucci loafers, you could buy an incredibly well-crafted thing that's made of very fine materials. It's hand-stitched by some sort of Italian rustic. Where do sneakers fit into that kind of craft and provenance story for you, Jeff?
Well, for sure, those the high-end designers really make much better product stitch for stitch. This is the thing that they're missing, though, and this is the reason why Gucci and Prada sneakers likely will never be as covetable as like Nike, Jordans, or Adidas. It's because sneakers mix all these different other subcultures into the fabric of their shoes. And when I say fabric, I mean like the sole of their shoes. So it's obviously sport is there, but then it's also mixing in fashion. You know, you look at all these brands that are now collaborating with high fashion designers. So they're inspired by high fashion. They're inspired by music. They're inspired by technology and performance, which has to go into a sneaker, right? and of course the sport itself. So you've got all of these different cultures into this one product. Whereas, you know, you could go out and buy a Balenciaga shoe and yeah, you spent, you know, $1,200 on it, but it's just inspired from high fashion, couture, runway. There's no element of sport, technology, hip hop, you know, current trend, social media. There's none of that other stuff. So it's quite isolated in this sort of like Mount Everest peak. Sneakers have this other thing where it's like a petri dish of all this other culture. And I think that's why those sneakers really win.
And Jeff, today when you walk down the street, what shoes stand out to you as potential classics of the future?
It's funny. I have this really big problem where when I meet someone, I look down first. I look at people's feet first, and it's so bad because it's like, yes, I'm sort of judging people by the footwear that they have on. But right now, the problem that's happening right now is the information for these shoes that are covetable. And like you said, like there's five guys in your office that are, you know, quote unquote cool and in the know. And in the first week, they all have the same shoes, right? So before, that would have been one guy that was really in the know. And then there was this kind of like passing down of information orally of like, you got to know this guy, you got to go in the back warehouse, ask him for this in like the secret way. And then he might be lucky enough to give you the pair. So it took a lot longer. Now, because of social media and blogs and the internet, everyone's got the coolest shoe in the same week. So you go to a party where, you know, these guys hang out and everyone looks exactly the same. And it's almost ironic because now the guy who comes in with the thing that you could buy at your local, you know, soccer shop, he's got the thing that's different now. So it's like everyone's wearing limited edition. So then it's not really anymore a limited edition thing. It's kind of like I always equate it to like nobody wants to be in the VIP room all by themselves. But if the entire club's in the VIP room, the VIP room ends up being the general dance floor. And that's kind of what's happening with sneakers right now. Sneaker companies are releasing so many limited edition shoes. Every week, there's like seven releases of a limited edition shoe. It almost feels like they're releasing more limited editions than general releases, which is sort of counterintuitive to the definitions of the word. So now when I look at a guy, you know, and he's wearing the quote-unquote hypest shoes, it's like, yeah, it's like I let out a sigh, like, oh, you're that guy. Okay. You know, and then so you try to one-up him with something that is not limited edition that you might have found in a bargain basement, 2 for $10 rack. And he's like, whoa, what are those? And then, you know, you're like, oh, don't worry about it. I have my connections. Really, you got them at like the discount store. And that's kind of really cool to me.
Nice. You can make your own cool. I'm glad to hear that that is still the case, Jeff. Yes. Just finally, what's the most expensive pair of sneakers or the most valuable pair of sneakers you have been on the basketball court or you've been for a run in?
It would be the Pigeon Dunks that I designed. I played.
Man alive, are you crazy?
I did. And they actually made news when I played basketball. People were taking spy pictures of me playing basketball in them. And, you know, the headline was like, Jeff plays an $8,000 pair of Pigeon Dunks. It's crazy. But
nice fun. Yeah. Well, it's a fantastic topic. Thank you for bringing it to life for us. Jeff Staple on the line from California. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And there we have it, Andrew, for edition, that's it, for edition 317 of the Monocle Weekly. Nice to get some sneakers in there.
Jeff Staple was really good.
Yeah,
I
he
like
was.
Him.
We should have, he noticed how he sidestepped the question about how do you, you know, what's going to be the next big thing.
I know, because he's collecting them, isn't he?
He's collecting them, so we can't do it.
He's putting them in boxes.
Do you think you could rate the people in the office, rate their footwear? Do you go for the gaudy, because you're a sneaker wearer, you don't go for the gaudy trainer, you go for the more of the classic. You've got a nice pair of New Balance.
That's correct. Yeah. I'm a fan of New Balance. But
you've got those nice kind of shoey, sneakery ones that are like a sort of classic Stan Smithy kind of
yeah,
humor.
I've got quite a few. But I think in the office, Tom Reynolds, he's a bit of a sneakerhead.
Yeah.
But we did ask him if he would like to pose a question. And the most exciting thing up, the thing that he could come up with, comfort or style? Which is more important? So he wasn't allowed to pose any questions.
He didn't cut the mustard, did he? He didn't make the grade.
But he has nice footwear.
He'll be upstairs as we speak, nursing his inbox of 13 emails.
And he does worry about people treading on his toes with his new sneakers as well.
That's the sneakerhead when you they actually sort of bring some other shoes to change into for the sort of drinking part of the day as the sun goes down. Anyway, there we have it. That was edition 317 of the Monocle Weekly. Let's thank our friends behind the glass. Today's show was produced by Tom Hall and our studio manager was Claire Urban. The Monocle Weekly will be back same time, same place next week. But for the time being, from me, Robert Bound.
And me, Andrew Tuck.
Thanks for tuning in.